From the studios of the Mayo Clinic News Network, this is Mayo Clinic Radio, exploring the latest developments in health and medicine and what they mean to you.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio. I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCray.
The number of smokers in the U.S. has fallen to a record low, but there's a new problem. Electronic or e-cigarettes, which are increasingly popular among teenagers and young adults.
On today's program, we'll learn more about quitting smoking and the hazards of e-cigs from a Mayo Clinic expert.
And I sort of lament smoking kills 480,000 people each year, and I've got three drugs that I can use, and erectile dysfunction kills no one, and I got 50. So it just shows you where we put our priorities.
Also on the program, we'll hear two patient stories. First, following a surgeon to Mayo Clinic, and one man's wish to make a difference through altruistic organ donation.
That's this week's program. Up next.
Tracy, there are a lot of people in this country who have given up cigarettes. According to the CDC, cigarette smoking has fallen to its lowest point in recorded history. In 2017, that's the last records that I could find available, an estimated 14% of adults smoke. That's about 34 million people, and that's nearly a 70% decline from 1965, when just over 43% of American adults smoked cigarettes, tobacco smokes. But now, we've got e-cigarettes.
Yeah, the teens are starting to pick up the slack.
Vaping.
Juul, the most popular e-cigarette on the market, was created to help smokers switch from cigarettes. But in fact, e-cigarettes have complicated this tobacco product landscape. They're not an FDA-approved quit aid, and now using e-cigarettes and vaping has become an epidemic among young people, including high schoolers. Here to talk about quitting smoking, nicotine addiction, and e-cigarettes and vaping is Dr. John Ebert, Associate Director of the Mayo Clinic Nicotine Dependence Center. It's good to see you again, Dr. Ebert.
Pleasure to be back. Thank you.
Well, I can't wait to hear the Juul story. But first, let's talk about congratulations to you and your colleagues for getting the smoking rate down to the lowest it's ever been. So how'd you do it?
So I think it was always a combination between public policy and then effective treatment. Most patients who quit smoking quit on their own, and I think a lot of that was clean indoor air and a lot of the local policies that were implemented to kind of restrain or constrain smokers. Because we know that if you have clean indoor air and good public policy, people are more likely to quit. In combination with that, a good effective therapies like varenicline, imipropion, and nicotine replacement have really been disseminated pretty well across the country. So we've done a good job on both reducing the incidence of people starting to smoke through public policy, but also treating effectively those people that are chronically dependent.
Now, for a long time, we didn't really know how detrimental smoking was. Wasn't it 1960 when the Surgeon General's report came out and they said that there was a connection, a link between cigarette smoking and lung cancer? Nothing about the heart, nothing about your increased risk for stroke, right? I mean, we didn't know how bad this was.
It took a good long while, and that's the challenging thing, I think, is when we talk about e-cigarettes that we'll have to sort of discuss and think about. It takes a good long while for a large population of people to be using or abusing a substance before we can actually start to truly understand what the true health risks are. So we started mass producing cigarettes for our troops in the early 1900s, but it wasn't until 1950s, until JAMA came out with the case control study associating smoking with lung cancer, that we were like, oh, there's something really going on here. So it took about, 30 or 40 years to get that data out there. And then we could start to piece the other, you know, the heart and the lung and the liver and the nerves and the brain and all those other
things.
And everything else, right? It took a while to get, but it takes a while to understand what the health risks are in a broad population of patients.
And today, in the 21st century, if you're smoking, I would say you probably know that you should not be smoking. I don't think there's any discussion there, but it's the nicotine that makes it so hard for people to give up smoking.
Correct. And I think what you're seeing too, it's interesting, it's not just smoking yes or no, but the types of smokers that we're seeing. So in the 60s and 70s, the vast majority of smokers were daily smokers. What we're seeing now is that a significant percentage of these patients are non-daily smokers. So they smoke occasionally. So there may be some differences in risk perception. I think that the message is very clear. If you're a daily smoker, that, you know, there's these attendant health risks, but you will get patients coming in and saying, but I don't smoke every day, doctor, so what is my true health risk? And that's due to some of these complexities of understanding risk and communicating risk and public policy. Yeah, you're not a daily smoker, so actually sitting in a restaurant for 4 hours is not very hard. But your risk is when you leave that restaurant and smoke. But being in that restaurant for 4 hours doesn't make you quit. That's the deal.
Is there any drug that's more addictive than nicotine?
So abuse liability is, that's an excellent question. And I think we always struggle with that when we talk about addiction is, what makes something addictive or what makes something reinforcing? So it's all about reinforcement. Nicotine and heroin and alcohol all have different complexities with relation to the legality of them. So how do you measure addiction? Is it reinforcement? Reinforcement is different for everybody. And you may look at just the prevalence across the population and say the most prevalent drug use is cannabis, but it's not the most addictive. So there's a lot of other things that sort of play into what addiction is. And so it's hard to say, but there's no question nicotine is incredibly reinforcing.
And doesn't it get to your brain pretty quickly after you inhale?
Correct. And when we talk about addictions and we talk about drugs of addiction and drugs of abuse, and we talk about what is really making someone continuing to use a substance, it has everything to do with reinforcement. And reinforcement is directly related to how quickly you can get a drug into the central nervous system and in what concentration. And there is nothing that is faster than pulmonary delivery or something, a drug delivered through the lung.
You know, I think I remember Richard Hurt saying, Dr. Richard Hurt, who was part of the Nicotine Dependence Center for so many years and did so much great work. But he said, you know, if alcohol got into your system as fast as nicotine did, it would probably be just as addictive.
Yes, absolutely. And once again, it's a speed of delivery. And when people smoke heroin compared to injecting heroin, it's a faster delivery. So it's much more reinforcing. So I think that's generally true.
So, as I said, anybody who is smoking knows that for their health, they should not be smoking. So what is it that has changed in the decades to make it easier to quit smoking? What are some of the aids that work?
So I think the aids that we really talk about are really three. And I sort of lament as a primary care clinician that smoking kills 480,000 people each year, and I've got three drugs that I can use, and erectile dysfunction kills no one, and I got 50. So it just shows you where we put our priorities. But anyway, so I think the drugs are nicotine replacement and bupropion, which is an antidepressant, and then varenicline, which is a medication that actually blocks the nicotine receptor. Those are the three drugs we have.
And what are the trade names of those?
So
Chantix one.
So Chantix is varenicline, and bupropion is sold as Wellbutrin or Zyban.
Okay.
And then nicotine, there are many different nicotine replacements. Nicorette is one. Okay. Those are the different products.
Yeah. All right. And tell us about your success rates now. I know you've got several different programs at the Nicotine Dependence Center. Just outline briefly what those programs are and your success rates.
So we know in tobacco treatment that there's a dose effect. That is, the more intervention that you provide, the higher the success rate. So for example, if you talk about a quit line where you can disseminate to a broad population and anybody in a state can call in a quit line, our quit rates in a quit line, for example, are about 3 to 8%. Those are low rates, but it's across a broad population. And so when you get more intervention, like face-to-face, like we have the Outpatient Nicotine Dependence Center, our quit rates are about 25% at 6 months to 12 months.
So that's counseling, basically.
Counseling, talking. Correct. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so it's counseling.
But that's without any nicotine replacement, without any drugs.
Right.
So you're at 25%.
Yep. And then when you get into the residential treatment program where you're providing nicotine replacement and you're inpatient basically for 8 days, you know, in the building two blocks down from here, we take patients in and put them in for 8 days, and we provide them intensive counseling and work with them with medications. Our quit rates are about 50% at 6 to 12 months. So not 100%, but the more intense the intervention, the higher your quit rates.
But you can also prescribe nicotine replacement and some of those drugs as an outpatient. They don't have to come in Correct. To get those.
Correct. That's a great point. The nicotine replacement therapies that are available over the counter are the gum, the patch, the lozenge, and then there's an inhaler and a nasal spray, which are available by prescription. And then the bupropion, which is the antidepressant, is available by prescription. And then varenicline or Chantix, as you mentioned, is available by prescription. So some of them are over the counter and some of them are prescription.
The landscape has been muddied a little bit by what are called e-cigarettes, which have become extremely popular among young individuals. In a word, what do you think of e-cigarettes?
So the challenge with e-cigarettes is it really presents a unique really sort of unparalleled experience in public health, where a device could be used to help one group reduce their risk for dying from tobacco-related illness, at the same time increasing the risk in another population.
Yeah. Are e-cigarettes vaping, and is all vaping e-cigarettes?
So most of the time, e-cigarettes are kind of referred to generally or generically as anything, you know, in one of these vaporization devices. There are e-pipes and e-cigars, but really I think that terminology e-cigarettes refers to any of these vaping devices generally.
Now, what I understand about vaping and e-cigarettes is that the levels of nicotine are so much higher than a regular cigarette. Is that true?
So when you talk about higher, there's a couple things that you can talk about. You can talk about the content in the e-liquid, or you can talk about the delivery to the user. There are some studies that demonstrate that users of e-cigarettes, electronic cigarettes or e-cigs, are higher than people smoking conventional tobacco cigarettes. So, yeah, we do see that in some populations.
So you're even more addicted because you're getting even more nicotine.
So there is. Theoretically, is a potential adverse consequence of being exposed to more of a drug, as you potentially are more dependent.
Well, one of the things I've heard is that the concern is that teenagers will vape and then they will become a cigarette smoker. But I'm not sure why they would ever take a step back, like they would use a cigarette as their step down method from vaping because the level of nicotine is less.
Yeah, so I think the question really is if you look at, so if we just take smokers who smoke conventional cigarettes out of the equation and just really talk about adolescents and ask the question, what's really happening and what's going on in that population? We're concerned about the thing that you mentioned, which is adolescents using e-cigs and then actually going to conventional tobacco cigarettes, harm escalation, if you will. So they're increasing their harm. And you're wondering if that is outweighed by the likelihood of kids who otherwise would have smoked conventional cigarettes who don't because they can use e-cigs. And on balance, it seems to be that both things are happening. It's probably true, if you look at the population, that kids that would have wound up smoking conventional cigarettes anyway are probably less likely to be doing so because they can continue on the e-cigarettes. But it's probably also true that adolescents who never would have smoked conventional cigarettes are more likely to be doing that because of the gateway phenomenon of electronic cigarettes. Both things are happening. The question is, what is the population impact overall, and what do we as a society want to do about it?
So the most popular e-cigarette out there is still Juul?
That is correct.
And the two guys who started that company said that they wanted to make tobacco obsolete, wanted to make cigarettes obsolete. But then what happened? I mean, all the youth in America, so it's very popular in high schools, it's very popular in colleges, and they didn't really intend that, but it's turned it into a $16 billion company.
Correct. And I think when you look at intent and you look at what they say, you may infer two different things. One of the things that I think you could say is that if you hadn't designed Juul to look like a flash drive, perhaps not as many adolescents would use it. If you hadn't made it so small and concealable, perhaps not. So there's a lot of issues that when you look at intent and you look at the design of these products might actually influence who takes them up. Let me give you an example. So there's data out there in the literature that suggests that if you're a smoker smoking conventional tobacco cigarettes and switch to e-cigarettes, you're more likely to use a device that looks like a conventional cigarette. Mm. But if you are a never cigarette smoker, you're more likely to use something that looks like a flash drive. So intent and design could be a way that you think about figuring out exactly what's happening in the industry, what's happening in the market, and who's more likely to use what product.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, truly. So when we're talking about e-cigarettes and the nicotine content, but these are not regulated, so there's potentially some other stuff in there, isn't there? Like carcinogens and THC and toxic chemicals, right?
Absolutely. And when we're looking at these devices, it's fascinating to think about how those toxic chemicals are being created. So the devices work by using a heated coil, and that coil is metal, different types of metal, nichrome and canthal and stainless steel and nickel and titanium are the classic metals they use. And what happens is when you take an e-liquid, which contains formaldehyde, or it doesn't contain formaldehyde at baseline, but contains vegetable glycerin and propylene glycol, and you heat that with one of those metals, you produce formaldehyde through the heating and the oxidation process of those e-liquids. So it is potential. It is a potential to think about aerosolization in a different way, not through heated, that could potentially reduce the risk. There's data out there, very interesting, that suggests when you look at e-liquid, before you aerosolize it or make it a vapor, and then you actually make it a vapor with the heated coil, you produce 18 new chemical species that didn't exist before.
Wow.
Yeah, pretty amazing. So these e-cigarettes, as we mentioned, are extremely popular. Why? I mean,
yep.
Is it the nicotine high? Is it what it does to kids' brains?
So I think that it is a fascinating and important consideration. Yes. That an electronic cigarette is a unique marriage between device and drug. So we live in an iPhone society where a lot of these devices have digital readouts, and you can adjust things, and you get feedback, and you can track puffs, and it's kind of like an app. And it also contains a drug. So your iPhone is just a device. But if the iPhone was, you know, married to a drug, that an iPhone plus drug, it would probably be the most addictive thing or potentially reinforcing thing out there. So I think there is a unique experience of the device and drug. And that's really what I think explains the e-cigarette phenomenon.
Well, now the FDA or the FTC or whoever it was outlawed flavoring cigarettes, tobacco cigarettes, but you can flavor e-cigarettes. How does that work?
So a lot of that is because the FDA, their deeming privileges or their oversight of this industry has not been currently enforced. And there are lots of interested parties out there who want to restrict flavors. So they don't want to have any flavorings for e-cigarettes. And there are groups out there that are advocating for that at the national level. But that's just because it's not regulated is why you get 7,700 flavors.
I had to laugh when you asked the why question, because what I've been thinking for the last 10 minutes is when I was a teenager, all the old people in my life, if you ask them about cigarettes, they would say, well, you look stupid when you're smoking. It just, you look ridiculous. And I thought, well, I don't know. I think they look kind of, you know, tough, kind of cool.
Cool. Like
and
the Marlboro man.
Now, yeah. When I see kids or young adults vaping, I just think that looks so stupid. I can't believe it. Mm-hmm. And I think, wow, I am
mature. You've matured.
Well, it's something about just like the old people in my life when I was a teenager. So there is definitely something to that.
What's interesting is I've been informally interviewing patients who come into our treatment program and asking them the question of, you know, you're trying to quit cigarette smoking, conventional cigarettes. Have you ever used an e-cigarette? And, you know, very frequently they'll say, yeah, I tried it, but it looks stupid.
And these are
smokers of cigarettes. So there are different perceptions and tastes.
Have you been dealing at the Mayo Nicotine Dependence Center with people who are addicted to vaping?
We have not. Usually people addicted to vaping are not seeking treatment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Would you say that vaping is a safer alternative to tobacco for adults?
So for adults who are trying to quit smoking, I would say that electronic cigarettes are 95% safer than conventional cigarettes.
All right.
They just look stupid.
Yeah, they just look stupid. Sure. All right, Dr. John Ebert. Okay. Well, cigarette smoking has fallen to its lowest point ever. Only 14% of Americans still smoke. Fewer young people are starting to smoke. Older smokers are dying and others are quitting. But now we've got a new problem. E-cigarettes, a new way to get addicted to nicotine and a popular pastime among America's young people. Unfortunate, I guess. Our thanks to Dr. John Ebert of the Mayo Nicotine Dependence Center. Great to have you with us.
Thank you for letting me be here.
Still to come on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll have two patient stories. One man follows his surgeon to Mayo Clinic.
And an altruistic kidney donor.
Coming up, a Health Minute with Vivian Williams.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams for the Mayo Clinic News Network. Let's talk about meditation, the practice of relaxing your mind and body. It's been shown to lower levels of anxiety, anger, depression, and tension. Maria Caselli, a group fitness instructor at Mayo Clinic, says one more benefit of meditation is reducing stress. Stress, anxiety, and a lack of sleep are problems that many people deal with every day. She says physically, people find they have improved mood, they sleep better, and they have better memory and concentration. And the benefits of just a few minutes of meditation a day can help, especially with stress. Now, meditation, or the practice of focused concentration and bringing yourself back to the moment over and over again, addresses stress, whether positive or negative, she says. Meditation can also reduce the areas of anxiety, chronic pain, depression, heart disease, and high blood pressure. For the Mayo Clinic News Network, I'm Vivian Williams.
When John Confalla found out he needed another valve replacement last year, he knew he wanted the same surgeon who had previously replaced the valve in 2007 at Ohio State University, which is near Mr. Confalla's hometown. That surgeon, Dr. Juan Crestanello, is now at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. So, what did Mr. Confalla do? Well, he packed up his bags and he headed to Minnesota.
Just what he should do. Yeah. Both men are with us today to share the story of how Mr. Confalla says that he got his life back. Joining us in studio is Mayo Clinic cardiovascular surgeon, Dr. Juan Crestanello. And on the phone from Powell, Ohio, is John Confalla. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks to both of you for being here. Mr. Confalla, when did you first meet Dr. Crestanello?
It would have actually been in 2006, sometime mid-year 2006. I had been diagnosed with a regurgitation of my original equipment aortic valve, and my cardiologist had set me up with Dr. Crestanello, and we had, through a series of examinations and meetings, were gauging the right time to perform the surgery, because although I had significant regurgitation, I was asymptomatic at the time. So, you know, we were trying to figure a time that was best and when we should proceed. And that time was January of 2007.
Okay, so just a second. Regurgitation, meaning that you had backflow. So the valve wasn't closing
all the way.
Is that right, Dr. Crestanello?
That's correct.
Okay.
So you had a new valve replaced in 2007. Did you always know that you would have to get another one, or was it a surprise when this one started to have trouble?
So Dr. Crestanello gave me we replaced my original valve with a bovine valve, and
Bovine.
So that's bovine. There are basically two types of artificial valves: mechanical valves and tissue valves. So these are one type of tissue valve that can be made of cow tissue or pig tissue.
Okay, so and that was 2007. And again, the question was, did you know this was probably ultimately going to wear out and you would need another surgery or not?
Yes. Dr. Crestanello had informed me that, you know, on average, those tissue valves last anywhere from 10 to 15 years. But that, you know, he assured me at the time that, you know, he did replacements and that, you know, it wasn't much more complicated than the initial surgery. So I went with the tissue valve because Dr. Crestanoa also indicated to me that the level of anticoagulation that would be needed post-op with a tissue valve is not the same. I would be taking an aspirin a day versus,
instead of something like Coumadin,
going on warfarin, that type of thing, which I would need with a mechanical valve.
Now, you knew that you wanted Dr. Crestanoa to be your surgeon again, but he packed up and moved to Rochester, Minnesota. Why did you want him to be your surgeon? Why were you willing to follow him here?
Because the confidence that he instilled, I had confidence in him, and he was just very reassuring the first time around, and I knew that if I ever needed another operation, that he was the person I wanted to have do it.
That's nice, Dr. Crestanoa. That's good to hear.
That's very nice of you. So I always remember Mr. Confada because of the discussions that we had in terms of the valve the selection. And as you probably know, he's an avid hockey player. Uh-huh. And, one of the discussions that we had was the issue of anticoagulation and playing hockey, ice hockey. He wanted to continue to do so. That's one of the main factors that played a role in 2007 in choosing the tissue valve versus a mechanical valve.
So you knew that he was going to get bumped and bruised, and you didn't want him on an anticoagulant any more than just aspirin.
Correct.
Okay, and then how did you get to Mayo?
By car? No, I'm just kidding. How long have you been here?
I trained here initially from 2001 to 2004, and then I moved to my first practice job, which was at Ohio State, and I was there for almost 14 years, and then I came back a year and a half ago.
Oh, good. It's been good here. You like
that? It's been fantastic.
So tell us about the most recent surgery. This bovine valve, this cow valve, wore out, and you needed to replace it.
Correct.
And what kind of valve did you use as a replacement?
Well, we end up using a mechanical valve, and that was a decision that we made together with Mr. Confada. And even though he already wanted to play hockey, but he already had gone through another operation, and we really didn't want to have this a third time.
Any post-op complications?
No, he did very well, and the most amazing. So he had his surgery and everything went extremely well, and then he went home, and like a couple of months later, I don't remember exactly the time, I get a letter on the mail with a picture of him on the ice hockey rink, mm-hmm. playing. And that was really a phenomenal source of gratification for me to see one, how thankful he was, and number two, more importantly, how well he has done after the surgery and being able to return to what he really likes to do.
But didn't he have a post-op infection?
No, he had a pre-operative. I mean, the reason why the valve deteriorated was an infection.
Oh, it was infected. Yes, so you had to get that cleared up before you put the new valve in.
Correct.
And our infectious disease colleagues helped with that.
Yes.
So how did you know it was infected? Did he have an infection in his bloodstream or...
Well, this is something that we did not know from before the surgery. That's something that we discovered at the time of the surgery.
Oh, okay. And so then you treated him with antibiotics postoperatively.
Correct.
Well, Mr. Confada, how are you feeling now? It sounds like it's back.
I feel fine. And actually, as a backdrop, in an interesting side like to the story is when I came to the Mayo Clinic in November for the second surgery. Now, mind you, I had not seen Dr. Crestanoa since 2007, And as soon as I walked into his office, I don't know if his, if my name resonated with him immediately, but he looked at me and he said, "You're my hockey playing patient." I knew I was in the right place.
Yeah, that's right.
When we talked about the options for replacing the valve, Dr. Crescinello informed me that there was a new version mechanical valve that he could use that would require a lower dose anticoagulation. And my wife was sitting next to me in this meeting, and she's a physician as well. And she looked to me when Dr. Crescinello indicated what the target INR blood thinning quotient would be for this mechanical valve. You know, she kind of looked at me and says, "Boy, you could play hockey on that level." You know that. And so after the operation and after I returned to Ohio, I went through my cardiac rehab at Ohio State, and I reconnected with my cardiologist down here, and had an echocardiogram in March, and that echocardiogram indicated that I had fully recovered, and then again completing the cardiac rehab. Once I completed those two steps, that's when I returned to the ice. I was had my INR under control and got a clean bill of health with the echocardiogram.
So INR, it's a measure of your how thin your blood is, and you need to keep it at a certain level.
Correct. Yeah. It's the INR is a measure of how quickly the blood clots.
Right. Well, what a great story.
Yeah, you're obviously a very grateful patient if you're willing to talk about how the whole process went.
And I have no problem sharing my story because I want other people that might be in a similar situation to know that, you know, these things can be, as Dr. Crescinello told me the first time in 2006, we can fix this.
All right. Patient Mr. John Confalla follows his surgeon to the Mayo Clinic. Now all is well, and he's actually back on the hockey rink. Thanks to our infectious disease colleagues and the skills of cardiovascular surgeon, Dr. Juan Crescinello. Thanks to both of you for sharing the story.
Thank you.
The word altruism, the definition is having or showing an unselfish concern for the welfare of others. And if you are such a person, you're known as altruistic.
Nice. That's a good thing to be.
Merriam-Webster and me are tight.
You would be the kind of person who might be likely to give a kidney to a complete stranger, like today's guest.
Exactly.
Mr. Skip Sturtz. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Skip, so nice to have you here. I just can't wait to hear this story. But first of all, a little bit of background. I mean, what's your occupation and do you have a family? And
Yeah, I have a family. I'm married for 32 years in August. And we have two kids, 22 or 23 and 26. And our 26-year-old just got married and our 23-year-old is an RN.
And you're how old?
I'm 59.
And retired?
Yes.
And what did you do for a living?
I worked for the Quaker Oats Company, and I retired in 2014. So now I'm a professional artist.
Have you always been an altruistic guy?
I don't think so. I had never even donated blood until a month before I did.
Why skip that step?
Yeah. Before I even did the testing, so a month before that, I decided to donate blood just so I could, because people kept asking me that.
Right.
So how did you decide to do this? What possessed you to give a kidney to someone you don't know?
Well, I didn't even know that you could give a kidney to somebody, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, a coworker who I worked with, her husband gave to their son, who was only like 5 years old. And I honestly thought that was dooming him for mm-hmm. life. I mean, and a lot of people think right. that when they're, you know, about donating a kidney. But I would do that. I mean, anyone would probably do that to save their child. So.
Right. Someone in their family.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't do that.
No. I guess I just always stuck in my head. And then 10 years went by, another decade went by, and we were raising our kids, we're working. But I always, anytime I would hear a kidney donor story, it would stick in my head. And I didn't know that a person could donate to somebody they didn't know. I always thought it was donating to a friend or a, a family member.
So as soon as you heard that you could donate to someone that you didn't know, did you say, that's for me? Or did that go in there for a little while and stick in?
That incubated too. Mm-hmm. I honestly told my wife probably 10 years ago that, you know, I think I could donate a kidney someday. Mm-hmm. And like I said, a decade went by then. Mm-hmm. And there was always a reason not to act upon it. I like to run. We were working hard. We were raising our family. And again, I would just always hear little stories here and there about it. And finally, after I retired, I had a mentor friend who just lived across the street, and he used to be an executive VP for a worldwide software company. And in his retirement, he worked with people or mentored people on kind of inventorying what was important to them in their life, following their careers. So going from success in their career to significance and doing something purposeful. And that's when the idea kind of really started to stick with me that I wanted to donate a kidney. And then I had a, but there was always an excuse to kind of research it. And I still didn't know a lot about it. I didn't know that you could live a normal life expectancy with two, mm-hmm. or just one, I mean. Mm-hmm. And so that was 2015, December of 2015. I had a friend who I run with, and he's an Ironman marathoner. And he posted a picture on Facebook of him standing at the Mayo Clinic in his room, recovering, and he's holding the big kidney pillow that they give you when you donate. And I was shocked, as he had told nobody about it. He just went ahead and did it. And that was really the kick in the pants that, and that's kind of when it just started, okay, I'm going to do this.
So you had a friend, someone yes. that you knew who had yes. done it, and you said, I think I'll do that.
Yeah. He had told me to call his transplant coordinator. Okay. And so I called and left her a message, and she emailed me back and kind of directed me to the place on the Mayo website where you kind of fill out a questionnaire and begin the process to decide if you're crazy or if you're healthy enough to donate.
How long did that process take?
I thought about that. I contacted them in December of 2017, mm-hmm. and a month later they called me. And within another month, I was down here in February of 2018 going through the 3 days of testing.
Now, tell us about the surgery. Was there any cost to you, and how long did it take to recover?
No, there was no cost to me whatsoever. I always had my medical card in my back pocket, you know, everywhere I went in this building or in Mayo. Mm-hmm. But there's no cost to the donor. It's all paid by the recipient's insurance.
Was it painful?
I had a couple hernia surgeries before over the last two decades, and I was kind of prepared for that kind of pain, and not really. It wasn't too bad.
And what was the recovery like? How long did it take you to recover?
So I was in the hospital for 2 days. I walked a lot in the hospital, and they put a fall risk thing on me. At that point, it became kind of this physical challenge because I'm a runner, and my whole idea is I wanted to train for a marathon, qualify for the Boston Marathon, recover for 3 weeks, donate a kidney, and then recover.
You're on a tight schedule.
And start training again for the 2020 Boston Marathon. And I did qualify, so I'm kind of on schedule here right
now. Wow.
Do you know who got your kidney?
Yes, I do know. So when you go through the pre-op, you write your email down on a card, and she was down in Jacksonville, and mm-hmm. she wrote her name on a card. And it's up to her to kind of initiate the contact, mm-hmm. and some never want to contact you. Sure. So you have to be at peace with that because that could be what happens.
What do you know about the recipient?
So we've communicated a lot of times just via email. She was 74 years old, and she's living life right now. She has 4 kids and 7 grandkids, and we've both expressed an interest in meeting, but she's too busy traveling.
How do you feel now that it's in your rearview mirror?
I thought it would be something that really over time, like to crescendo, would be the donation, but it's really, that was only the start, because now I just kind of always feel this desire to want to be an advocate for becoming a donor. And I don't try to sell any people on, you know, hey, you should go out and donate a kidney. You just have to feel it within. And in the mentor that I was talking about, he had me memorize a scripture, and it was 2 Corinthians 9:7, and it's, each man should give what he decides in his heart to give, not reluctantly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. So as I went through the whole process, that was always my kind of litmus test, that if I remained cheerful, then I was doing the right thing.
What are the most common questions you get from friends and family when they find out what you
did?
Well,
a lot of people oftentimes don't really want to talk about it. It's very uncomfortable for them, but eventually people get around to, you know, where they see that I'm doing fine and everything and I didn't compromise my life. They start to be curious and ask questions, but they wonder, so if they take out your right kidney, does it have to go in the where the recipient's right kidney is? Mm-hmm. And my son asked me if I was going to pee a lot after that. And so I just try to be real matter of fact and kind of explain that it's really as safe as an appendectomy, mm-hmm. or as risky as an appendectomy.
Are you aware of the fact that researchers have looked at people like you, and they've done brain scans on them and found out a couple of things. Number one, that their brains are bigger by about 9% compared to people who have never donated an organ.
Just a little town.
You got a big head. No, you got a big brain. And also, you probably have a large amygdala. And that's the area of the brain that controls compassion. And people like you have big amygdalas, most people. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting that the opposite is true of psychopaths. They have a amygdala.
They're not going to give a kidney.
You don't see many psychopaths who are organ donors.
Well, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Mr. Skip Sturtz, would you donate a kidney to someone you don't know?
I would. I can't, but I would.
All right. Well, I'll have to think about it. It would require some soul searching for most of us,
You've got some work to do in your retirement now.
That's true. But, you know, there are actually a couple of hundred people in the United States who do this every year, the gift of life to someone they don't even know. And people who do that are called extraordinary altruists for a good reason. And in fact, there are now 100,000 people in this country who are waiting for a kidney. Thank goodness for people like Skip Sturtz. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our program for this week.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our producer for the program is Jennifer O'Hara. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks for joining us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, newsnetwork.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.